Support for this podcast of The Exchange is brought to you by the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare, where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org. That's imagine.dh.org.
And this is The Exchange. Our guest today is Karima Banood, an internationally known Arab-American scholar, writer, and human rights activist. Her focus, the stories and struggles of Muslims standing up to Islamic fundamentalism. Banood's journey began in June of 1993 at her father's apartment in Algeria when a terrifying pounding came at the door. Intellectuals and professors, like her father, had been targeted by Islamic extremists, and many had been killed. Haroon feared it was her father's turn, so she armed herself with a kitchen paring knife and stationed herself by the door. Luckily, eventually, the pounding went away. The threats, however, did not, and her father had to leave the university and the city. But he kept writing and speaking against violence in the name of Islam, work that his daughter continues today. Karima Banood is in New Hampshire this week as part of an event with the World Affairs Council, and she's in our studios this hour. Let's hear from you as well. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Karima, it's really nice to meet you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, that story of the pounding at the door, and you told it in your TED Talk, it is terrifying. It's from what's often called Algeria's dark decade. Just remind us of what that was, Karima.
So that was Algeria's sort of decade-long nightmare that began in the early 1990s after the cancellation of some elections that it looked like the Islamic Salvation Front, one of the fundamentalist parties, was going to win. And there was popular protest against this possible victory because the Islamic Salvation Front was openly saying, we're going to get rid of the Constitution, we're going to get rid of the National Charter. Some of their firebrand leaders were saying, we're going to kill the unbelievers. So the electoral process was interrupted, and then the armed groups affiliated with the Islamic Salvation Front, and even more extreme than they, then declared jihad basically against the entire population. And ultimately, about 200,000 people were killed.
Wow, 200,000 people out of a country of roughly how many, Karima?
At that time, it was 40 million.
Wow, amazing. And how were you and your family living in Algeria at that time? I mean, were you bunkered down? Were you trying to work? What was going on for you and your father?
So my father was a professor at the university. He was an anthropology professor, and he very bravely taught evolution. And he had started already in the 80s to have problems with fundamentalist students who didn't want to have to read Darwin. And there was a long negotiation process with them. And he was very upset one day. He came home, and someone had written at the university the names of a number of very prominent Jewish intellectuals saying that you shouldn't read these people because they're Jews. And my father was absolutely horrified by this. So he was starting to see the rise of extremism in the university as well. When the violence broke out, he simply would not be silent. He cared so much about what was happening in his country. He kept writing against the extremists. Sometimes he was also critical of the government, which also committed abuses. And what was always something that made me sad was that the international community knew about the terrorists, but they didn't know about the people standing up to the terrorists. So my work is about trying to change that today.
Yeah, and there's so many stories in your book that we'll talk about for sure. But just a couple more questions about this time in Algeria, because as you said in your TED Talk, it informs what you're doing today. I mean, that was kind of the moment. You say in the talk, I knew at some level it was kind of ridiculous to defend my father with a paring knife, but I didn't have any other choice.
Yes, my father had tried to get the police on the phone, but they didn't answer. I mean, the police officers were being targeted and killed in great numbers already at that time in early 1993. So we were sort of really alone there. And as I say now, you know, my work is really about trying to find something more useful than standing in front of the door with a paring knife. But exactly a week before that day, one of my father's former colleagues from the university had been tied up by extremists in their apartment and killed in front of his children. And I was absolutely determined that was not going to happen at our house.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. Well, you said that, you know, this dark decade, again, all this upheaval and violence in Algeria, but there were threads of it beginning in the 80s. What feeds those threads, Karima, or fed those threads, at least in this Algerian case?
Well, that's a very important question. I mean, I think there are a number of factors, both internal and external factors. I mean, one was the sort of the lack of democracy in the single-party state, which meant that secular opposition couldn't be very well organized. And so when there finally was a bit of an opening in the late 80s after a sort of a popular revolt, the only people who were organized were the fundamentalists because they had been working through certain mosques. And the secular opposition was largely in disarray and really couldn't compete with them. They also had a great deal of support, financial support, ideological support from their fundamentalist colleagues elsewhere, and that made a very significant difference.
Elsewhere, meaning Saudi Arabia, Oman?
In the Gulf in particular. But then there was another factor that I think is very critical for Americans to think about, which is that at that time, the United States was supporting what were called the Mujahideen groups in Afghanistan that were fighting against the Soviet Union. And in the name of anti-communism, along with Saudi allies and the Pakistani government, there was a sort of an open call for jihadists to come from around the world. And a group of Algerians did go and actually fight against the Soviet Union. They were trained there. They came home. And the worst killers of the 1990s in Algeria, we called the Afghans because they were people who had battle experience in Afghanistan.
Wow. Well, just to finish up, what happened to your family in Algeria? And then I do want to talk to you about the threads that you're starting to connect already. So your dad eventually did have to leave his university job and his apartment. Where did he go? What did he do? What did you do? You were a law student at the time.
So I was a law student. I was very lucky. I was studying outside of the country. I tell the story in my book of a law student about the same age as I was, Emel Zanoun Zawani, who was studying in the country and who was very tragically killed for refusing to give up her studies. So I was very lucky. I was studying outside. My father moved to an area where a number of people, journalists, intellectuals, and others, people who were working in various public capacities, had to move for their security, although any time he would go out from there. You know, he said between 1993 and 1997, every time he left the house, he didn't know if he was going to come home again.
Wow.
Of course, he didn't tell us that at the time.
I mean, yeah, thanks, Dan.
He downplayed it. But the key point, my father would be horrified if I didn't say there were so many people like him who were speaking out, and so many families suffered so much more than we did. This is just to give you one story. And all those Algerian intellectuals who kept writing, people like Tahar Jaoud, people like Saeed Makbel, very prominent columnist, who kept writing, making fun of sometimes the fundamentalists, lampooning them, and really paid with their lives. We have to remember those people.
What eventually brought an end to this dark decade in Algeria?
Well, there were a number of factors that were crucial. One was popular opposition to terrorism over time, and that, I think, is a key lesson that we can take today.
That's what you're working on right now. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, the population was confused, I think, in the beginning as to what was happening because the extremists were using religious rhetoric and people were religious, but then they started to realize this is not the religion that we know. As my father wrote, you know, these terrorists are in radical break with the true Islam that was lived by our ancestors, and people began to turn against them. So the terrorists said no one can go to school. More and more and more mothers would walk their children to school. There were popular marches against terrorism, often organized in the first instance by women's groups, but then they really caught on. Now, the Algerian military also played a decisive role, although it has to be said that they committed some very serious abuses as well. There were about 8,000 forced disappearances. The exact numbers are somewhat debated, but nonetheless, there was the security component. But I think you cannot underestimate the component of popular struggle and popular opposition to terrorism and extremism. And today, I think it's critical the international community do everything it can to support that kind of force around the world.
Okay. And that'll be our theme probably for the rest of the hour, Karima, because that's the theme of your book and the theme of your talks. Join us 1-800-892-6477. Today in The Exchange, we're sitting down with Karima Bannoun, international human rights lawyer, author of Your Fatwa Does Not Apply Here, Untold Stories from the Fight Against Muslim Fundamentalism. You can find information on Karima's talk at the World Affairs Council tonight, along with a link to her TED Talk on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. You can join us now, too, with your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So, Karima, just picking up on what you said about your father, who said, and others who said, these people who are killing, who are saying, people shouldn't go to school, especially girls, they're not following Islam. A common refrain we often hear in the West is ordinary Muslims who abhor these violent expressions of their faith need to speak up, need to step up, need to counter this violent narrative. And this is often presented as a critique. How do you feel about that?
What I would say is that everyone knows who Osama bin Laden was, but very few people know about all of those standing up to the bin Ladens and the would-be bin Ladens in their contexts. And that we absolutely have to change. People don't know about the activists that I've seen in Pakistan, Muslim and Christian activists and atheists all together who went out and protested the condemning to death for blasphemy of a Christian woman when I was in Pakistan. Those same activists are in the street after virtually every suicide bombing. They don't know about the teacher who I met in northern Mali, Mr. Bodmar, he asked me to call him, who kept his school open while his town was occupied by the West African affiliate of Al-Qaeda, risking his life because he said, I have to protect the hope of my students. So what I would say is that not enough is being done, but so much is being done that goes unrecognized. If you use violence, it's very easy to be heard. If you stand up peacefully to the people using violence, it is very difficult for people to take notice of you. And we absolutely have to change that.
So is it a fair criticism? But you are saying it's already going on. We just don't know about it. Is that what you're saying?
I believe that we all have an obligation to speak out against abuses that are happening in the contexts in which we live, in groups with which we are affiliated. I absolutely agree with that. The point is that there are many Muslims and people of Muslim heritage who are doing that. More of us, especially in the diaspora, where we are largely safe, need to join them. And that's absolutely true. But this suggestion, we saw it even again yesterday in the New York Times, Thomas Friedman saying there really are no Syrian moderates. I mean, it's simply not true. It's just that for the most part, outside these people and their work is unknown.
And you've made it your business to make that work known.
While I'm trying to make a small contribution towards that, and a lot of other people are doing that, there's wonderful organizations that I work with, like the Network of Women Living Under Muslim Laws, and we need to support all of those organizations.
Here's my question. When you say we need to support these organizations, or when troops leave Afghanistan, you've said, we need to care. How does the United States or the West in general support, without these organizations, educators and so forth, without making them look like tools of the United States?
Well, certainly you have to be very thoughtful about that. But, one of the even very small things that we could do is simply listen to these people about what they have to say about their context and what they believe they need. And we're very often not even doing that. I mean, they know better than we do. And the story that you were referencing in my TED Talk is the story of Maria Bashir, who is the first and only woman chief prosecutor in Afghanistan. And when I met her, she had 23 bodyguards.
Which is amazing for one person.
For one person, because she had survived multiple attacks on her life. She had created in the prosecutor's office in Herat an office to investigate cases of violence against women, and this made her sort of Taliban target number one. She also was investigating corruption, which means that she had some other enemies as well. But she kept doing her work, and I remember her saying to me, how concerned she was at that time about the international community having forgotten women, that everybody was talking about women before. Now they've forgotten women because they want peace with the Taliban. And I kept thinking, you know, why is she not on television? Why, when we're talking about Afghanistan, are we not listening to someone like her? And I think we really need to do much more of that, including listening to people who don't speak English.
How is countering a violent Muslim fundamentalist narrative different or difficult or both for women like Maria?
Women play a critical role in this struggle, as they do in the struggle against all forms of religious fundamentalism around the world. And I'll never forget what a wonderful sociologist from Niger in West Africa said to me. She said, every step forward in the struggle for women's rights is a piece of the struggle against fundamentalism. And I think that's partly because, you know, everywhere in the world, fundamentalists target women's rights. So women are often sort of the first to recognize the danger because they're often the first targets. That's usually where the discussion starts. The same thing was true in Algeria. Back in the 90s, the first fundamentalist attacks were on widows who refused to remarry and were living by themselves and so on. And nobody really paid attention to that as political violence, but it was absolutely. So there's a way in which we also have to see that targeting of women as a kind of warning sign of the fundamentalism and terrorism to come. And again, you know, listen to women's voices. And they're all too often missing in our debates of current affairs.
That's so interesting. So keep an eye first on the human rights struggles of women as a bellwether or a canary in the coal mine, pull out whatever analogy you want. Trouble to come.
Absolutely. And the incredible thing is what women managed to achieve. I think about one of the women I interviewed, and her name is Yanar Mohammed. She was the founder of the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq, which today, given the situation in Iraq with so-called Islamic State, they are actually running shelters for women fleeing the violence of Islamic State. They actually have a helpline that you can call for assistance. All the while, they're openly denouncing IS on the ground. And I keep wondering again, you know, why is she not on television when we're talking about this? Why are we not finding creative ways to support and promote these sorts of endeavors?
Would they be afraid to be on television, to have those endeavors highlighted and making themselves even more of a target than they probably already are?
You know, that's always a decision for people to make for themselves. And I took that issue of the security of my interlocutors very seriously. But I can tell you in the case of Yanar Mohammed, she is incredibly outspoken, even though she had to live for several years wearing a bulletproof vest 24 hours a day. But she has been willing to speak out, as are many.
So here's another question for you, Karima, about women especially and the point that you just made. How does a Muslim woman, again, speak for women's rights without being portrayed as a sellout to Western society, Western culture? She wants to stay true to her Islamic faith. You know, she doesn't want to, I don't know, you know, put on a miniskirt and jump on a Harley. You know what I'm saying? She wants to stay true to those traditional Islamic values, but she also wants to make sure that women have the rights that they deserve. So how do you navigate that if you are a follower of the faith, especially in that more traditional way?
I mean, I would say a couple of things in response to that question. The first is that there are many different ways of being Muslim, just like there are many different ways of being Christian. And there are also people in these parts of the world who choose not to practice. So we have to remember that diversity. And I think what's very important to focus on is the idea of indigenous feminisms. I mean, there has been an ongoing women's human rights struggle in Muslim-majority regions of the world for centuries, just as there has been elsewhere. So this is not a Western idea. It didn't come from here. It's not about us teaching them about their rights at all. It is about the local version of that same struggle for women's full equality. Now, the organization that I mentioned, the Network of Women Living Under Muslim Laws, what I like about this network is it brings together people who use a range of strategies. Some use the strategy of sort of promoting human rights and a more secular view. Some use strategies of making arguments within religion, either sort of feminist reinterpretation of Islam, or even going back and saying, look, it's not a question of reinterpretation. You've got this all wrong. And in fact, women may choose one strategy at one time and another strategy at another time. Women work together using these different strategies. And there's a wonderful Tunisian law professor named Sana Ben Ashour who talks about how complementary, in fact, these strategies are. So it's not at all that women have to make a choice between, as it were, their culture and their rights. Women also have a right to define their culture in a way that includes their rights. And that is as authentic as any other expression of Islam.
When they speak about their rights, when they say, hey, our daughters have a right to an education, are they sometimes told, especially by these fundamentalist groups, that you're going against Islam?
Oh, absolutely.
And you'll be targeted for that.
Absolutely. I mean, that is the tool that the fundamentalists use. They sort of appoint themselves the representatives of God. There was a wonderful Tunisian human rights lawyer I interviewed, and she said precisely that no one has the right to claim himself to be the representative of God. No human being has the right to do that. And, you know, I think this is a tool that is deployed against women. And this same human rights lawyer, Alia Shamari, she said, look, you can say you're against the rights of women, but just say it's because you're conservative. Not because you're a Muslim, because, you know, my Islam is different than yours. I believe that it holds the equality of women and men.
In the West, we often view Islamic nations as nations that don't see women in the same roles that we do, as, you know, the heads of companies, as political leaders. So that's the view that we have in the West of those societies.
I think it's clear that there is a very serious problem of discrimination against women in the Middle East and North Africa region, South Asia and beyond. This is certainly not a problem that's exclusive to Muslims, but it is a particular challenge in Muslim-majority contexts right now. If you look at sort of the gender index that was drawn up by the World Economic Forum, the countries in this region are not doing great. But there are also many amazing, empowered women's human rights activists who are pushing back. You know, there were women I met, young women in Afghanistan who had organized street protests against sexual harassment of women on the streets of Kabul, Afghanistan.
That's pretty brave.
It's pretty brave, absolutely. What I think is absolutely critical is to get beyond the stereotypes and to remember, you know, people like to talk about a clash of civilizations. I think there is a clash within civilizations in the world, within all of them, between those who are seeking to advance women's rights and those who are pushing back. That's a global thing. That's not between cultures. That's across every culture in the world. And the point is to try to find those forces who are seeking to advance human rights and make sure that, you know, we're paying attention to them, we're listening to them, we're promoting their work in any way that we can.
And you promote the work of men as well. And I definitely want to talk to you about some of the amazing men that you profile. But just one more question on these women, because they are so brave. They are at risk and they're putting everything on the line for themselves and their daughters especially. What motivates them? Or that's not right, the right way to put it. But, you know, how do they keep going given the extreme danger and the extreme difficulty?
This was a question I asked people again and again. So I think about Deep Saida, who was one of the Pakistani activists organizing the protests against terrorism. One of those protests, she was told, well, if you do this, suicide bombers will be coming to the event. And she said on the phone to whoever made that call, well, come if you must, but we'll be there too. And I asked her about this. I mean, how do you keep doing this? You have children. And she said, I believe that if I live the life of a coward, it will not make any sense. I asked Maria Bashir the same question. Why do you keep doing this? As she said, she repeated to me, she sort of laughed. She said, you mean why you risk not living? She said, well, everybody asks me that question. And she said, and I'll never forget this because it was with no bravado whatsoever. She said that it was simply that a better future for other Maria Bashirs was worth the risk.
All right. Coming up, a lot more of our conversation, a lot more stories to uncover with Karima Bannoun. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking with international human rights lawyer Karima Bannoun, author of Your Fatwa Does Not Apply Here, Untold Stories from the Fight Against Muslim Fundamentalism. You can find information on Karima's talk at the World Affairs Council tonight, along with a link to her TED Talk on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. You can also join us right now with your questions, comments, 1-800 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Karima, I wanted to ask you about the popular struggle against Muslim fundamentalism that you've been describing. You know, individual people, writers, journalists, artists, lawyers, countering this narrative of violence that we see from fundamentalist groups. You've called this one of the most important and overlooked human rights struggles in the world. A couple questions there. First of all, a human rights struggle. Why is it important to frame it that way?
I think it's important to frame it that way because the idea of the universality of human rights is a critical weapon in the struggle against fundamentalism. All fundamentalists, Muslim fundamentalists in particular, believe that, you know, people's rights are entirely determined by the categories they fit in, and those people are sort of automatically assigned to those categories. It's not about self-identification. And the idea of universal human rights is that all human beings have the same human rights regardless of the categories they fit in, and in fact, they have the right to self-identify. And so I think it's absolutely critical to frame it that way. I also think that this gets beyond the idea that this is a struggle between the West and Islam. It is not. This is a battle between the far right, the extreme right wing in Muslim majority contexts, and sort of the middle and the left, as well as human rights defenders. And I think it's absolutely critical to understand it in that way.
So if you had your druthers, your queen for a day, and you could make everybody in this country, since this is where we are, you could make everybody see this as a human rights struggle, how would they think, view, talk about this differently?
Well, first of all, then you wouldn't be able to have, presidential candidates who suggest that Muslims shouldn't be president, presuming somehow that all Muslims think the same thing and thinking that that's even an appropriate generalization to make at all. I think that it would really combat some of the discrimination and the stereotypes against Muslims, which is also a goal of my work that we see on the right and the far right in this country. But I also think for people sometimes on the left who either think somehow that, you know, the fundamentalists are representing legitimate grievances or representing an authentic, you know, view from within, they would really have to question those views as well and recognize that there is a very significant constituency that is sort of analogous to them, that shares the same values of tolerance and progress and so on the ground, that is pushing back against these movements and needs their solidarity.
So just as we watch the news and we see people struggling with a famine, or we see groups being pushed out of certain areas by ISIS, and it's a very deliberate, you know, group of folks, we feel like we need to help them. And that's our first concern.
Well, certainly, I mean, support, humanitarian support for local populations that are being affected by fundamentalist violence is absolutely critical. And indeed, one of the big push factors in the migrant and refugee crisis in Europe is, of course, Muslim fundamentalist violence. I mean, many of these people are either fleeing from Syria, where they're either fleeing, of course, the government, can't forget that side of the violence as well, or the jihadist armed groups, fleeing from Iraq, fleeing from Afghanistan, fleeing from Somalia. In all of these instances, you know, one of the big factors is this extremist violence. And if we want to deal with that issue, we're going to have to go back to the source and really help those who are trying to tackle the problem on the ground.
Is that preferable, Karima, to drones, bombs, airstrikes, military support for groups that we think might help us on the ground, like the Kurds? Is that preferable? Where does that fit in?
I would say that it depends entirely on the context. I do believe that people have a right to be protected from armed movements that are openly targeting civilians and killing thousands of people, whether it's in northern Nigeria or in Iraq. But, of course, any such force has to be used in accordance with international law. I'm a professor of international law. There is a role, of course, for force in these contexts, but it can only be, as one Algerian journalist said to me, the tip of the iceberg. You also need an educational response, a humanitarian response, an ideological response, a political response, an economic response, and so on. And if we just sort of think we can solve the problem, using force, we're going to be battling the same problem problem somewhere else next year. We've got to take on the ideology, the underlying ideology.
How can the United States help with that fight, the fight that you're waging, again, telling the stories of these groups, the educators, the artists, the writers, and so forth, who are countering violent Islam in their own countries? How does the U.S. do that appropriately, again, in a way that isn't us meddling?
I mean, I think there's a big role for civil society in the U.S. to play here in inviting these people to come and speak, in translating their work, in putting on some of their artistic performances here, in writing about them. I mean, all of that is absolutely critical. We're seeing the other voices on TV. You know, that's who we give the microphone to. That's who we give a lot of airtime to. And I think even just this starting to shift the way that we look at this would be absolutely critical.
Again, our number here in The Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Join us, 1-800-892-NHPR. What questions do you have for our guest about moderate Islam and those inside Muslim countries who are fighting fundamentalism? Why do you think these stories about the people that Karima talks about are not being told? 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, our guest this hour in The Exchange, Karima Banoon, international human rights lawyer, author of Your Fatwa Does Not Apply Here, Untold Stories from the Fight Against Muslim Fundamentalism. There are a lot of stories in the book, Karima, and you've touched on a few, but there are also some stories that we haven't talked about yet. I spent a summer running a puppet show as a summer job. There's a puppeteer in your book. How is a puppeteer fighting against radical Islam?
Very creatively.
Yeah.
So that's the story of Faizan Pirzada, who used to head what's called the Rafi Pir Theater Workshop in Lahore in Pakistan. And he also ran a museum of puppetry, was very committed puppeteer. And his family's cultural festivals began to be targeted by jihadists. They were told what they were doing was against Islam. Faizan was actually quite a religious person in a very spiritual way, and he absolutely rejected that. And they continued doing what they were doing, bringing in artists to perform across Pakistan. But the jihadists continued as well. And finally, in 2008, one of their festivals was actually blown up. Now, luckily, no one was killed. A number of people were injured. But they faced this terrible decision. What do we do? Do we stop now or do we go ahead? And the family collectively decided at about 1 in the morning, as he said it, ladies and gentlemen, this ain't going to work. This festival is going to go ahead. There's nothing against Islam in this. But they didn't know if anybody would even come. I mean, think about it. Would you go to the theater if there was a chance that it could blow up around you?
Probably not.
Probably not. But in fact, the next day, more people than they had ever had at any of their events turned out, really to show their support for culture in the face of violence.
What did he say about that? And when I heard you speak about this in your TED Talk, by the way, I was moved to tears.
Well, he was thrilled and he was also terrified because he knew that he was responsible
right.
in a way. And he ran up to a young woman who had come in with two small children. And he said, you do know there was a bomb here yesterday and you do know that there could be another bomb today. And she said, I know that, but I used to go to your festivals with my mother when I was about their age. And I still remember that. And we have to be here. And that's the kind of courage it takes to stand up to terrorists.
And everybody exhale because it went fine.
Yes. So then I went to their next event in 2010 in that same venue, and we were all very nervous because in that era when the Pakistani Taliban were targeting girls' schools, the Pirzadas actually decided to stage girls' school theater. It's an amazingly courageous thing to do. And you sat there thinking, you know, oh my goodness, are we going to get to the end of the show? And I'll never forget the moment when we did. You know, the whole theater was sort of filled with this peaceful boom of applause and people were crying. And I remember thinking in that moment that the bombers made headlines 2 years before, but that night and those peaceful people were as important to the story.
Let's take some calls again, Karima. Our phone number here in The Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. 1-800-892-6477. And Karima, first up is Anita calling from Enfield. Hi, Anita. Go ahead. You're in The Exchange. Welcome.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. I'm actually kind of curious as to what you think about the entire shift of the global populace moving further to the right. I mean, we are seeing it here in the United States as well.
In terms of what,
oh, in
Anita?
Terms of a, yeah. In terms of the struggle, I mean, if this is the case in the Middle East, and your guest had described it as a struggle between the far right and the middle and the left, I feel that it, politically, that's where we are at, both here and in Europe.
Okay. Anita, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for the question. I do think it's very important to note that in all of these contexts that I'm talking about, there is also a middle and there is also a left. There are trade unions. There are feminists, women's rights advocates, youth movements. In Algeria now, there's a very big movement against fracking. You know, there are all these social movements that are out there that we may not know about. And the more extreme voices, you know, tend to make the headlines. So I do think that those forces are there and we shouldn't be overly sort of pessimistic about this. But I also think one critical thing that's happening around the world is the way that the media is promoting, unfortunately, extreme views in that part of the world. Some of the trans-Arab media, unfortunately, has, for example, Al Jazeera in Arabic, has been promoting fundamentalist preachers making all sorts of statements about how women should dress, about social practice and sexuality and from a very sort of far-right wing extreme perspective. And that is something that has to be challenged. Unfortunately, the opponents of that don't have that same media access. So that's one of their big struggles. But, of course, social media helps a little bit.
So you're saying Al Jazeera, the Arabic language stream anyway, is promoting this more fundamentalist point of view?
Well, that certainly has been the criticism made of Al Jazeera Arabic by many of the activists on the ground. There's actually a lot of anger at Al Jazeera. I know that it is sometimes thought of here in the West as sort of a progressive alternative, and Al Jazeera English is different. But that is not at all the perception that people have of the role that's been played by Al Jazeera Arabic. You know, for example, back in 2007, there was a terrible bombing by Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb in Algiers at UN headquarters. And I talk about this in the book because it actually killed my childhood next-door neighbor, Shadli Hamza, who was a wonderful man working for the UN Development Program. And Al Jazeera ran this sort of popular survey where they sort of went to different places in the Arab world asking people if this was a legitimate attack or not. And there was a lot of anger about that in Algeria. You know, why would you frame it that way? And I think that's shifting a bit. But, you know, I don't want to just pick on them. I mean, I think there's a big problem as well with fundamentalist radio stations and newspapers that lean that way. And all of that has to be challenged by progressive media. And it's not easy.
So, Karima, who is getting that microphone? And again, we're not going to spend the rest of the hour picking on Al Jazeera, but is Al Jazeera, our other Arab world media, giving a microphone to the puppeteer, to the human rights, the lawyer working in, the prosecutor working in Afghanistan, to the people running the girls' schools and so forth? Are they getting a microphone from anybody?
Sometimes, and certainly from local people, from supporters, as I mentioned with the Pirzadas, with the thousands of people who came out and supported them. Sometimes these people are well known in their own contexts. I think about somebody I talk about a lot in the book, Sharifa Kedar, who is the head of the Algerian Association of Victims of Islamist Terrorism. She lost her brother and her sister to the armed Islamic group back in 1996. She is interviewed a great deal. She's very well known nationally. In fact, she was just here in the U.S. for the summit around the General Assembly on countering violent extremism, but not nearly enough. I mean, the problem of visibility is both a problem at the national and local levels as well as a problem at the international level. I mean, part of it is a question of resources. You know, as I mentioned, the fundamentalists have transnational support. There is a huge amount of funding that has come from the Gulf region in particular to support these movements, to help them create their own media outlets. They have access to certain mosques, and I have to stress certain mosques, certainly by not the majority or all mosques by any means. And so there are many places where, you know, they have to be countered. And this is a real uphill battle for the people that I'm talking about in my book.
So those who have more money get a bigger microphone.
That's the global reality, unfortunately.
And also, being in the news business, you know, when things blow up, that tends to attract reporters more than when, you know, people are doing amazing things, but nothing is blowing up. I mean, I hate to put it that way, but, you know, someone doing something wonderful often doesn't make headlines. I'm not saying it's right, but that's sort of the way things go.
Absolutely. I was thinking back to something that happened in Algeria in the dark decade, the Amarouche Boulevard bombing, which was a terrible bombing carried out about exactly 20 years ago by the armed Islamic group on the streets of Algiers that killed many civilians. And if you look now sort of on the internet, you can find a little bit of news coverage of that. But what you won't find, unless you dig in the archives in the Algerian press, which I have done a bit of, what you won't find is coverage of the demonstration the following day at the bomb crater, where women's rights activists led the protest there and filled the bomb crater with flowers. And it seems to me that that story is as important as the attack itself.
Who do you want to tell these stories about the people by the bomb crater, for example? Al Jazeera, The Washington Post, local media? What would make you feel like, okay, this has gotten the attention it deserves finally?
I mean, I think the answer is all of the above. I mean, in education as well. We proceed in our debate all too often, our public debate, you know, as if there were no people doing this work. You know, one can see this time and again, you know, where are the Muslims who speak out? Well, as I say, again, there are not yet enough people who are doing this, but there are many who are, and we're not even paying attention to them. When I tell these stories very often, the reaction is total surprise, and people say, oh, I had no idea. I never heard of this before. I never heard of Pakistanis going out and protesting after suicide bombings. That has to change.
Let's take another call. And this is Steve in Bedford. Hi, Steve. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead with Karima Banoon.
Yes. Hi. Thanks for taking my call again. I just have a quick question. I wonder how now I understand why all the Algerians are living in France. Obviously, they fled the time that you're talking about. And how are they doing as a group? Because as Laura was just pointing out, all we hear about are the bad things, you know, the riots and the burning cars and stuff like that. But there must be more to the story than that.
Steve, thank you so much for the call. Yeah, getting back to our conversation about the dark decade, which a lot of people don't know about.
I would say the Algerian community in France is quite diverse. There are a number of waves of migration that have happened. There are those who went during the colonial period. There are those who went immediately after independence. My father was an anthropologist and actually did his field work in France among one of those early post-independence waves of migrant workers back in the 70s. I remember that very clearly. Those were migrant workers, mainly men, who were not allowed to bring their families with them and were living in quite difficult circumstances financially. Then there is a whole wave of refugees who came during the 1990s, during the dark decade. Unfortunately, there were also some supporters of the fundamentalist movement who came and continue to be active in fundamentalist organizations now in France. But there are many victims of the fundamentalists. I talk about Samia Alalu in my book, who was the presenter of my favorite TV show in Algeria when I was a kid, Bled Musique, whose producer was the victim of an attack and is today a paraplegic. She's now fled to France and is a women's rights activist there. So it's a very mixed picture in the community. They confront, on the one hand, discrimination, racism, but they're also battling fundamentalism.
Okay, Steve, thank you for the question. More with Karima Banoon in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today we're talking with Karima Banoon, author of Your Fatwa Does Not Apply Here, Untold Stories from the Fight Against Muslim Fundamentalism. Banoon tells the stories of artists, journalists, educators, activists, who she says represent one of the best hopes for ending fundamentalist oppression. She'll be speaking at the World Affairs Council tonight in Manchester. You can find more information about that, along with a link to her TED Talk, on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. You can also join us now with a phone call, question, comment, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Karima, Amy from Littleton is waiting on the line. Hi, Amy. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I really appreciate what Karima has to say about reframing that idea of how we interact with the conflicts that are going on around Islam. But I had a question about how she uses the term jihad, because my understanding of that term in Islam and the Quran is that it is a personal internal struggle with your own religious struggle for your own faith, and that it really only gets turned outside of one's individual self if the religion is attacking other people unprovoked, I think, is disingenuous and co-opting the term and kind of distorting the meaning.
Amy, yeah, thank you so much for calling in, because this is really important. Language matters here. And I love that she brought up our use, everybody's use of the word jihad. Go ahead, Karima, please.
That's a great question. There's something that I quote in the book that I love from an Algerian expert on terrorism called Lies Boukra, who writes that jihadism is not jihad. In other words, these extreme armed movements today that are claiming to be carrying out this form of jihad are actually acting in violation also of Islamic law. And they've really twisted that law. And then there's a big debate about then whether we should even use the term jihadist to describe them. And I can tell you that many of the experts from the region, many of the opponents of these movements do, in fact, use that term based on sort of the self-identification of these movements. But you're absolutely right. I mean, there's also a strain of thinking that suggests that in some ways, you know, this is to dignify what they're doing. There are various forms of jihad in Islam and Islamic law. And you mentioned, you know, one of which is said to be the most important, which is sort of internal personal struggle to be a better person. So in a way, there's sort of a jihad about what jihad means. But it's absolutely critical to understand that these groups are trying to claim this concept. In Algeria, for example, the armed groups declared jihad on the population, you know, in their view. Obviously, it was completely illegitimate to do this. And they use this thing called takfir, which is where you sort of declare other Muslims not to be good Muslims, and therefore you can use force against them to sort of re-Islamize them. I mean, all of this is completely unorthodox, and, you know, there's a big debate about its exact status. But I think we do have to be specific about what we're dealing with, and this is where I get nervous about the term violent extremism, because to me it's a euphemism.
Well, let's talk more about terms then. And I know you've talked about this in your writings, Karima. What's the best term to use? People say Muslim fundamentalism, Islamic extremists, Islamic terrorism. I mean, what's the best language to use?
I use the term Muslim fundamentalist violence, and I like the term fundamentalism. I use the definition in the book from an Algerian sociologist who says that fundamentalisms are political movements of the extreme right that in a context of globalization manipulate religion to achieve political aims. And I like this, A, because it's something that we find across different religious traditions. All the world's great religions today are afflicted by various forms of fundamentalism, although in Muslim-majority context at the moment, this is taking a sort of a very particular armed form that is especially pernicious. But I also like that definition because it really centers the way these are political movements. So I think that's the term that I use. I also do think that we've spent way too much time talking about what to call this as opposed to what to do about it. During the White House summit last February, the whole debate was about what to call it. That is an important debate. But I'm happy to work with people who want to call it something else and want to join together to defeat it.
Let's talk more about what to do about it. And you've talked so much this hour about supporting the, again, activists, writers, ordinary educators and so forth who are countering this narrative, who are standing up. I haven't heard you talk yet, though, Karima, about religious leaders to counter this narrative. You've talked a lot about really amazing people, you know, from all walks of life, but not religious folks.
So there's a story in the book that I love called The Liberal Mullah of Herat, again, another story from Western Afghanistan, who was an elderly gentleman I met. And when I met him, so a mullah, a religious leader, when I met him, he was actually leading a workshop on women's rights and speaking out. I mean, his idea of women's rights and might not be exactly the same, but he was very specifically speaking out against child marriage and forced marriage in Afghanistan and insisting on the right of women to consent to marriage or not, and insisting that if men, brothers and husbands, violate women's rights, you know, that's not real Islam. They're not real Muslims. Incredibly courageous. He was facing a lot of threats to do that, and I really admire somebody like him.
A liberal mullah. Those words aren't often put together.
Absolutely. Well, there is liberal Muslim clergy all around the world. In some places, they are under attack. So in the Caucasus, you know, we haven't been really covering this in the media in the U.S., but in the Caucasus, there have been many, many killings of some of these liberal clergy, Muslim clergy, who've been speaking out against the extremists and, as they call them in that context, Wahhabis.
So, and liberal, we mean not in the American sense of, you know, whether you support the minimum wage or, you know, those things. We're talking liberal mullahs in a different context than liberal in this country.
Well, I would mean people who promote what would generally be called internationally as liberal values of tolerance and openness and a more moderate view of religion and equality and so on, that perhaps both some conservatives and many liberals in this country would support. But I would say this. I think there's a critical role to be played by religious leaders. I think about Imam Sharif Muhammad, who I interviewed in Minneapolis, outspoken in the Somali community against al-Shabaab recruitment. But I think it can't just be religious leaders. There's been too much emphasis on this, because the reality is that the fundamentalists are not going to be swayed by this sector of the clergy that they see as kind of sellouts.
Illegitimate anyway, right. So go ahead, finish that thought.
So my point is that it has to be really a multi-sectoral response. I mean, I do think it's critical for clergy to speak out, especially for undecided young people to hear that, and also to play a really positive role in religious education, which is human rights affirming. That protects young people from being swayed by extremists. But it can't just be religious leaders. We also have to look at women leaders and figures in the arts and culture trade unionists and political leaders and people across all walks of life.
Well, and speaking of young people being swayed, there's a story in the book, right, of a Somali, I think you're going there anyway, of a Somali American who worked with sort of disaffected Somali youth in the Midwest and tried to get them not to join extremist groups.
That's a story that I love. It's the story of a gentleman named Abdurazak Bihi, who is a Somali-American activist in Minneapolis. And he brought his sister and her son to live in Minneapolis and put the son in a youth group. And unfortunately, in that youth group, he was preyed upon and recruited by al-Shabaab, ended up going back to Somalia, this honor student who wanted to be a doctor. He really didn't know anything about Somalia. He wasn't a terrorist. He wanted to come home. He lost his glasses. And al-Shabaab finally killed him.
Wow.
And his uncle, I think, felt so terrible about this and began campaigning against recruitment, both by al-Shabaab in the first instance, but now by Islamic State in the Minneapolis area. And he does this with no resources. So he does very creative things. He organized a Ramadan basketball tournament after an al-Shabaab suicide bombing on a sporting event.
Wow. Okay, a little bit more there. A basketball tournament after an attack. That's another one of those amazingly brave moments.
Yes. So it was an attack on World Cup viewers in Uganda by al-Shabaab. There had been a fatwa against sport. And Mr. Bihi decided, I have to do something to give young people an alternative. So he organized this Ramadan basketball tournament, bringing together young people and professionals to show that you can be a Muslim and celebrate Ramadan and embrace sport at the same time. And last year, when al-Shabaab threatened Mall of America, Mr. Bihi and others organized a sort of picnic sit-in at Mall of America to show solidarity with the workers there.
Now, I am not familiar with that attack threat on the Mall of America in Minneapolis. So fill me in a little bit there and the work that he did, because that's not a story that, again, made news. Part of your frustration, I know, Karima.
So I can't remember the month exactly, but it was last spring. I think it might have been in March or April. Al-Shabaab issued a threat against a number of malls, including the West Edmonton Mall in Canada that I just visited actually last week, and the Mall of America. And as Mr. Bihi said, you know, they have nothing to offer but fear. You know, that's why they make these sorts of threats. And so when they went and sort of organized this picnic sit-in, he said, you know, the best way for us to counter that fear is with our presence, our peaceful presence. So he was determined to be there. Now, no one's quite sure how credible that threat was. But as we know, al-Shabaab carried out a terrible attack on a mall in Kenya.
Absolutely.
That killed 67 people. And I was just in Kenya in the summer and, in fact, went to visit the survivors of the Garissa University attack, where 147 people were killed by al-Shabaab last spring, mostly students. And I'll never forget one of those young students who was a Christian who told me that her life was saved by a Somali Muslim family that lived on the borders of the university. And she remains so determined to work in her career going forward in the struggle against terrorism. And again, the international community really has to support those victims.
I want to ask you about one more story, Karima, please, that you touched on earlier this hour. A devastating story doesn't end well for a 22-year-old law student in Algeria. You mentioned her before, a young woman named ML, who was killed because she was pursuing her education. And it is just a terrible, terrible story. You said earlier you were one of the lucky ones. You were studying outside Algeria. She stayed inside and was killed for that. And you said that you try to find ML's hope. Where do you find it? It's such a sad story.
In fact, ML's name means hope in Arabic, and I found it in several places. The first was in the courage of all of the victims who talked to me and the victims' families telling stories that were sometimes very painful to tell, like ML's story. I mean, she was taken off a bus at the age of 22 on her way home to spend a Ramadan evening with her family, and her throat was actually cut in the street in front of all of the other passengers. And yet her family found the courage to tell the story. They keep telling the story inside Algeria today. Her sister actually went to law school and became a lawyer.
Which is unbelievable.
It's amazing.
It'd be so easy to cower inside your house.
Absolutely. It's partly, you know, it was possible because the armed groups were largely defeated in Algeria. But I also found ML's hope, you know, literally everywhere that people are standing up to fundamentalism peacefully the way that she did.
Anything else you want to add to that ML hope, Karima? Just, I don't know, what you see people doing to kind of carry on.
Well, I'll never forget when an Afghan woman said to me, her security situation was so bad, she asked me not to use her name. Mm. And she said, optimism is key to survival. I think we have to be aware of how grave this problem is, but also optimistic that it can be solved with civil society actors around the world working together.
All right. Karima, thank you so much. And I hope you enjoy New Hampshire. I hope we have some good weather for you.
Thank you very much
for being here. Again, that's Karima Benoun. She's author of Your Fatwa Does Not Apply Here, Untold Stories from the Fight Against Muslim Fundamentalism. You can find more information about her talk tonight in Manchester with the World Affairs Council and a link to her TED Talk on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. This is The Exchange on NHPR.